This is disc number 2.
At the next turning, the romantic mansion appeared on the gentle eminence of old novels. It was a splendid country house, 3 stories high, built of pale brick and purplish stone, whose tints and substance seemed to interchange their effects in certain lights. Notwithstanding the variety, amplitude, and animation of great trees that had long replaced the 2 regular rows of stylized saplings, thrown in by the mind of the architect rather than observed by the eye of a painter, Van immediately recognized Ardis Hall, as depicted in the 200-year-old aquarelle that hung in his father's dressing room. The mansion sat on a rise overlooking an abstract meadow with 2 tiny people in cocked hats conversing not far from a stylized cow. None of the family was at home when Van arrived. A servant-in-waiting took his horse. He entered the Gothic archway of the hall where Boutein, the old bald butler who unprofessionally now wore a mustache, dyed a rich gravy brown, met him with jested delight. He had once been the valet of Van's father.
"Je parie," he said, "que monsieur ne me reconnaît pas,"
and proceeded to remind Van of what Van had already recollected, unaided. The Farmannequin, a special kind of box kite, untraceable nowadays even in the greatest museums housing the toys of the past, which Boutein had helped him to fly one day in a meadow dotted with buttercups. Both looked up. The tiny red rectangle hung for an instant askew in a blue spring sky. The hall was famous for its painted ceilings. It was too early for tea. Would Van like him or a maid to unpack? "Oh, one of the maids," said Van, wondering briefly what item in a schoolboy's luggage might be supposed to shock a housemaid. The picture of naked ivory reverie? A model? Who cared, now that he was a man? Acting upon the butler's suggestion, he went to make a tour du jardin. As he followed a winding path, soundlessly stepping on its soft pink sand in the cloth gumshoes that were part of the school uniform, he came upon a person whom he recognized with disgust as being his former French governess. The place swarmed with ghosts. She was sitting on a green bench under the Persian lilacs, a parasol in one hand, and in the other a book from which she was reading aloud to a small girl who was picking her nose and examining with dreamy satisfaction her finger before wiping it on the edge of the bench. Van decided she must be Ardelia, the eldest of the 2 little cousins he was supposed to get acquainted with. Actually, it was Lucette, the younger one, a neutral child of 8 with a fringe of shiny reddish-blonde hair and a freckled button for nose. She had had pneumonia in spring and was still veiled by an odd air of remoteness that children, especially impish children, retain for some time after brushing through death. Mademoiselle La Riviere suddenly looked over at Van over her green spectacles, and he had to cope with another warm welcome. In contrast to Albert, she had not changed at all since the days she used to come 3 times a week to Dark Veen's house in town with a bag full of books and the tiny tremulous poodlet, now dead, that could not be left behind. It had glistening eyes like sad black olives. Presently they all strolled back, the governess shaking in reminiscent grief her big-chinned, big-nosed head under the moiré of her parasol. Lucy gratingly dragging a garden hoe she had found, and young Van in his trim gray suit and flowing tie, with his hands behind his back, looking down at his neatly stepping mute feet, trying to place them in line for no special reason. A Victoria had stopped at the porch. A lady who resembled Van's mother and a dark-haired girl of 11 or 12, preceded by a fluid dackle, were getting out. Ada carried an untidy bunch of wildflowers. She wore a white frock with a black jacket, and there was a white bow in her long hair. He never saw that dress again, and when he mentioned it in retrospective evocation, she invariably retorted that he must have dreamt it. She never had one like that. Never could have put on a dark blazer on such a hot day,
but he stuck to his initial image of her to the last. Some 10 years ago, not long before or after his fourth birthday, and toward the end of his mother's long stay in a sanatorium, Aunt Marina had swooped upon him in a public park where there were pheasants in a big cage. She advised his nurse to mind her own business and took him to a booth near the band shell where she bought him an emerald stick of peppermint candy and told him that if his father wished, she would replace his mother, and that you could not feed the birds without Lady Amherst's permission. Or so he understood. They now had tea in a prettily furnished corner of the otherwise very austere central hall from which rose the grand staircase. They sat on chairs upholstered in silk around a pretty table. Ada's black jacket and a pink-yellow-blue nosegay she had composed of anemones, celandines, and columbines lay on a stool of oak. The dog got more bits of cake than it did ordinarily. Price, the mournful old footman who brought the cream for the strawberries, resembled Van's teacher of history, Gigi Jones.
"He resembles my teacher of history," said Van when the man had gone.
"I used to love history," said Marina. "I loved to identify myself with famous women. There's a ladybird on your plate, Yvonne. Especially with famous beauties, Lincoln's second wife or Queen Josephine."
"Yes, I've noticed. It's beautifully done. We've got a similar set at home."
"Slivok, some cream. I hope you speak Russian," Marina asked Van as she poured him a cup of tea.
"Neohotno no sovershino svobodno."
"Reluctantly, but quite fluently," replied Van.
"Slega ulibnuvshis,"
with a slight smile.
"Yes, lots of cream and 3 lumps of sugar.
Ada and I share your extravagant tastes. Dostoevsky liked it with raspberry syrup."
"Pah!"
uttered Ada. Marina's portrait, a rather good oil by Tresham, hanging above her on the wall, showed her wearing the picture hat she had used for the rehearsal of a hunting scene 10 years ago, romantically brimmed, with a rainbow wing and a great drooping plume of black banded silver. And Van, as he recalled the cage in the park and his mother somewhere in a cage of her own, experienced an odd sense of mystery, as if the commentators of his destiny had gone into a huddle. Marina's face was now made up to imitate her former looks, but fashions had changed. Her cotton dress was a rustic print. Her auburn locks were bleached and no longer tumbled down her temples, and nothing in her attire or adornments echoed the dash of her riding crop in the picture, and the tegular pattern of her brilliant plumage, which Tresham had rendered with ornithological skill. There was not much to remember about that first tea. He noticed Ada's trick of hiding her fingernails by fisting her hand or stretching it with the palm turned upward when helping herself to a biscuit. She was bored and embarrassed by everything her mother said, and when the latter started to talk about the tarn, otherwise the new reservoir, he noted that Ada was no longer sitting next to him, but standing a little way off with her back to the tea table at an open casement with the slim-waisted dog on a chair peering over splayed front paws out into the garden too. And she was asking it in a private whisper what it was it had sniffed.
"You can see the tarn from the library window," said Marina. "Presently, Ada will show you all the rooms in the house."
"Ada?"
She pronounced it the Russian way, with 2 deep, dark A's, making it sound rather like ardor.
"You can catch a glint of it from here, too," said Ada, turning her head, and pollice verso,
introducing the view to Van, who put his cup down, wiped his mouth with a tiny embroidered napkin, and stuffing it into his trouser pocket, went up to the dark-haired, pale-armed girl. As he bent toward her, he was 3 inches taller and the double of that when she married a Greek Catholic, and his shadow held the bridal crown over her from behind, she moved her head to make him move his to the required angle, and her hair touched his neck. In his first dreams of her, this reenacted contact, so light, so brief, invariably proved to be beyond the dreamer's endurance,
and like a lifted sword signaled fire and violent release.
"Finish your tea, my precious," called Marina.
Presently, as Marina had promised, the two children went upstairs.
"Why do stairs creak so desperately when two children go upstairs?" she thought,
looking up at the balustrade along which two left hands progressed with strikingly similar flips and glides, like siblings taking their first dancing lesson.
"After all, we were twin sisters. Everybody knows that."
The same slow heave, she in front, he behind, took them over the last two steps, and the staircase was silent again.
"Old-fashioned qualms," said Marina.